All right, here we are back in studio, Presidio. Bitcoin Jam. Good to see you guys.
What's up? See you,
gentlemen.
And we brought our little friend from Vegas.
I feel like we're back home.
Yeah, back home. We took last week. You know, anybody who watches this regularly on Fridays would have said we took last week off, but little did they know we were out trying to buy beef tallow fries.
Unsuccessfully.
That's another story. Vegas. Did you end up going to Steak and Shake in Vegas?
No. Others have, though. But I think you discovered there's three, and two of them support Bitcoin, and the one
on the way to the airport does not. But he knew what we were talking about, and he's like, let me talk to my boss, the manager here. He knows about it. We're trying to get this in, so I think it's coming. But yeah, we were trying to do it the easy way, just on the way to the airport. You got to go like the opposite way.
I felt bad for the guy because as we were coming out, I saw someone without doxing that I recognized from BitDev here, and I'm sure like every 2 seconds, I pay with Bitcoin. He's like, no. It's got to be very disheartening. But most of them did work, we heard. So,
well, I'm really happy you guys decided to come. And It was fun to host the show.
It was different, right?
It's a different format. I think we had like 20 minutes or something. And we had our, Frank helped us out. So yeah. That was cool. But I'm glad we did it.
Yeah.
It was fun.
It was cool.
But it is nice to be back home.
In our
Bitcoin studio.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's talk. Like, so we all experienced the Vegas conference. If you follow Twitter, it's a lot of people hate on it that weren't there, but I think that's a little unfair. I think it's great when Bitcoiners are like, worried about suits and Wall Street and politicians.
Yeah,
absolutely. Let's keep that up.
Yeah.
But having said that, I feel like that conference in general, whether it's in Miami, Nashville, or Vegas. It is what you make of it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I didn't spend all day long at the main stage listening to politicians. Right. I saw tons of Bitcoin developers there that I know really well or I've met for the first time in person. So that was great. And then Block had a really big presence. So it was fun to see their presence there and be part of that.
Yeah. Miles had a great keynote for Block, right?
The biggest keynote of the entire presentation.
Miles killed it.
Yeah.
He really had a great keynote.
His hair was just glowing.
It's a lot of great.
That man's been serving.
Yeah, Miles looks great. It was great. There are a lot of great things to say and share. He both went over a history of how Block's contributed to Bitcoin. I don't think my company actually gets the fair shake it should for how much it's contributed to Bitcoin. So it's good for him to like outline all that. And then of course there was new information too and news around Square accepting Bitcoin payments. And they delivered, is a great delivery by him as well. So that was good. And of course the three of us had a speaking opportunity. I had a couple more too on topics that are spicy and things I care about. So that was great.
I wanted to get a little bit of the download from you because I was traveling, didn't get the seed versus seedless thing, right? That kind of blew up as a big debate and a lot of FUD back and forth. And then I think you gave a talk on that on Thursday.
I was a moderator for a conversation.
That's
so the way that came about. Yeah. I mean, I have been a champion of seedless for 4+ years, and that just stems from my own learnings of how to manage private keys. And realizing, and we talked about in January on our show, did a deep dive on different ways to custody your Bitcoin and the trade-offs. And there's no silver bullet. There's no one solution that is best for everyone, right? We definitely concluded that. But certainly I feel with quite deep conviction that to properly manage seed phrases or more generally, direct access to private key material, you have to do a lot of homework and a lot of research. And if you do, it's quite powerful. There are definitely advantages to having seed phrases. But I think most people are not equipped to do that yet. And sure, we should encourage them to like take that journey and learn. It does empower them. But I would also say that a lot of people who haven't yet or will never take that journey, they're better off with emerging solutions that are seedless, where they still control their private keys than with custodians. So in any case, I've been a longtime champion of that. That's why I've been a longtime champion of the BitKey design, and I hope others do it. So maybe 2-3 months ago, I reached out to the conference organizers saying, hey, let's tackle this spicy topic, right? It's spicy because most products in the space, self-custody products, have seed phrases. And so, of course, those vendors promote that and the advantages of that. as they should. That's what their product does. And yep. there are advantages to that approach. But a missing conversation is like the drawbacks to that and the advantages of seedless. And Casa kind of did that, but because they don't produce their own hardware, it's kind of a ham-fisted solution. The conference is like, yeah, let's do a panel. So that's the panel I was on as the moderator. In parallel to that, and I wasn't even aware of this, the Bicky team, the commercial team, decided to like go all in on marketing this at the conference. So it wasn't like coordinated with this panel that I had put together. And they, you know, they definitely created a lot of conversation because it was, you know, a provocative approach to marketing. So the panel, I moderated. Zach Herbert from Foundation was on the panel.
That's a hardware wallet, right? Foundation.
Yeah. Yep. And Seed from SeedSigner was on the panel. That's like a do-it-yourself hardware wallet. So it, like that's even like more hardcore than even like ColdCard, because you the customer put the hardware together, so you can assemble like sort of off the shelf parts and put it together, and so you reduce the trust you have even in like the hardware maker. And then Max Guy is from the BitKey team. So my role, I try to be as unbiased as possible, despite working for Block and being a BitKey shill. But I really, you know, I love the SeedSigner project and Foundation as well. So that panel was good though. I mean, it took me a little by surprise because like there was less debate and controversy on that panel. We needed NVK to really spice it up. But generally, there's a lot of agreement that we do need. It's good to have a lot of options.
And yeah, everybody recognizes
there are pros and cons. Yeah. Uh-huh. And there was less criticism of the BitKey approach that I was expecting to hear on that panel. So I was trying my hardest to like poke at BitKey.
You're suggesting people in person are a little bit less
There's that as well. That goes for everyone, including MBK. I mean, yeah. I'll have a beer with MBK.
I'm sure in person. Yeah. You would agree with a lot of things for sure.
So, yeah, so that panel was, I think it was like educational, but it is less spicy than maybe it could have been. But definitely it's spicy on social media. You know, MBK's poking a lot at Jack and Block and the BitKey team. You know, some of the things he says are accurate. Or I mean, like, it depends on what scope you're saying. If someone's led to believe that BitKey overall is safer and has no drawbacks, well, that's not the conclusion you should take.
Yeah.
If you scope it to just seed phrases, yes or no, then there's a set of advantages and disadvantages to both approaches. It's completely reasonable that an objective person could walk away from that and conclude seedless is safer. Now, BitKey has privacy issues. It doesn't have the hardware device, doesn't have a display. There's other issues with it for security, but that wasn't, if you scope it to just seed phrases, yes or no, that's not part of that discussion. So it depends on what you're comparing.
Yeah. I mean, like with anything, there's a lot of nuance, and I think that's a very deep debate, and it depends on, you know, who you are, what your risk models are, how, you know, deep you are in Bitcoin. But before we go all the way down that rabbit hole, I would love to maybe just get a couple other top impressions from the Vegas conference, because I think there's a lot we could talk about from that. So for me, I just want to offer a couple things. I mean, I was only there very briefly, and I'm glad you ended up, you know, getting us to come along. The first was I went to Meow Wolf with
Kevin. Oh, yeah.
I don't know if I'm doxing them the night before. That was awesome. I highly recommend anyone that goes to Santa Fe or Vegas, and a couple other cities are coming. Really cool immersive art experience. That was the second highlight, I would say, of the conference for me. First highlight was us doing our segment, which I don't know if we ever actually did share that, but we should, because I think it was really cool to me just to see the interest and openness, I guess, from Frank. That's the same Frank, right?
Yeah.
Around what we're trying to do with Presidio Bitcoin and building the bridge to Silicon Valley. I thought it was really maybe heartening to see some of the traditional Bitcoin community realize, oh man, there's so much opportunity. Like, it sounded by the end of it, he was ready to go all in on vibe coding with you.
Yeah.
I thought was really awesome.
People came up to me afterwards and wanted to talk about vibe coding and projects they had, or like, hey, I'm not a developer, but I want to do this thing. So people were literally coming up to me after our segment and asking for more information about it.
So I thought that was really hopeful and cool, and like a really good first step to kind of rebuilding some of that bridge. Yeah. Two other things that really stuck out to me from the conference, which I'm sure we'll talk about some of them more in depth today, but one was payments in general. So it was cool. I did purchase a t-shirt with Bitcoin using a Square terminal. So that was fucking awesome. Mm. To be fair, it was challenging because of not because of Block's fault or anything, but internet issues. Getting internet in there, they had to have like a PM or someone from the team come and give me like Wi-Fi. So I was on a bit of short time and a bit rushed, but we did get it to work. So that was very cool. And there's some huge implications. The only talk I did watch was Miles's. And if anyone hasn't seen that, I highly recommend you watch it. I'm sure we're going to talk a lot more about the Lightning routing piece, which is extremely exciting to me. Mm-hmm. And then the second thing that I took away from the conference, which is also potentially something for us to go deep on today, was at a lunch, which you were actually there as well. I heard someone be very, very, very strong, someone I respect, that basically Tether on Tron has already won. And so I think that's a very interesting potential topic for discussing with Circle and all that.
Somebody who's very informed on the topic and had very high conviction that like it was over, stop talking about this. And I was kind of like, I was sort of shocked to hear
that. Shocked too.
We'll go deeper on that.
Yeah,
we'll get into that on this episode.
Yeah.
Let's make sure.
But those are my high level takeaways. And yeah, to your point, Steve, I think I'll also just say like, you know, if you wanted to do this in like a very shilly, you know, whatever, draped up and dripped out shit, that experience was there. If you wanted to like hang out with open source developers and learn a lot of stuff, that experience was also there. Your point stands.
And we don't have to go in depth, but the other talk I did was on the main stage on Wednesday. And I'm super happy they allowed me on the main stage because most of the main stage was like the vice president, like suits and stuff like that. And
this
was me and Harry Sudak and
it's come up.
Taj Raja. Well, it's less about that. It's like the topic we covered was about how to change Bitcoin in a leaderless protocol.
That's cool.
Or in the flip of that is like, how does Bitcoin not change? The reason I thought it was main stage worthy is because that is something everyone should care about, even if you're suit, even if you are only in it for the number to go up.
Yep.
You don't want Bitcoin to break and you don't want it to like change out from under you. You don't want the monetary policy to change, right? So it was great that the conference allowed that topic on the main stage. And you know, we had like 26 minutes. It's a topic worthy of like an entire like university degree. But I thought we did a really good job of being pretty broad and somewhat deep in 26 minutes. So if anyone's interested in that topic, you can go check it out.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
I had a couple quick things that I didn't share ahead of time. but they'll be quick. And they're both related to Apple.
Ooh, okay. All right.
So there's a group of us.
The fruit or the company?
There's a group of us who really want to see NFC payments work for Bitcoin, right? If anyone's used Apple Pay or any kind of NFC payments, it's a beautiful user experience, right? And it just blows away having to open an app and use an app. Right now, it is possible on Android to send and receive NFC payments from like a Bitcoin wallet, or an app on an Android phone. On an iPhone, it's possible to send NFC payments, but not receive NFC payments.
Hmm.
And that's because Apple restricts or previously didn't even have the API. Now they have an API, but they restrict its usage to set the NFC, the phone into a read-write mode or like the mode you need to receive. So they do have an API now. So there are, I'm in a group with a bunch of other wallet developers and we're like, let's try to submit this to Apple and see what happens. So Phoenix did, and it works in the EU.
In the EU?
In the EU. It was just put in the App Store like hours ago. So I tried it here, and the NFC button shows up. Awesome. I tap that, and it says, sorry, you're not in the EU. So everyone ex-EU, sadly, has a horrible user experience.
Is that because the EU regulation is forcing them to enable that?
Yeah. So it's a real shame. I think we need, so everyone listening and you guys, we need to put pressure on Apple.
Yeah.
To enable this great experience. It would be so amazing to be able to like from your iPhone receive payments NFC style.
Amazing.
Is that like do you think that's a business model issue for Apple or do you think that's like a regulatory or security privacy or like what's driving that?
I don't really know. I mean, clearly they want to protect Apple Pay.
Yep.
But even what we're asking here, it's not the same thing as double clicking on your hard the side physical button on your phone.
Yeah.
It's literally opening an app. So I don't think that competes too much with them, but it's probably just protecting Apple Pay, is my guess.
And receive does that in a different way than send?
You mean business model or technically? Technically, it's different. NFC, it's the protocol is different whether you're sender or receiver.
Hmm. Right. I guess I'm just thinking, it sounds like, if I heard right, you can use NFC to send and you can't use it to receive. And that's just a restriction that Apple has flexed on in EU, but is not flexing on in the US so far.
It's unclear. I mean, they didn't have the API before. Now they do. So, I mean, they clearly are opening up.
Yeah.
Or else why would they have, I mean, well, or they're facing pressure. But
yeah.
And you can partner with them. I mean, I'm sure an American company can partner with them and then it would work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, but that's not an open API.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So that's one thing. So I get the ask there for everyone is to put pressure on Apple. The second thing to put pressure
that's via tweeting
on Apple.
Call your Apple representative.
Matt Velez posted on Twitter or on X yesterday about he did a little bit of analysis of where to put the Bitcoin B symbol on a physical keyboard. Right.
Oh yeah.
Anyone right. go open yeah, so, up your open oh, up yeah, your MacBook yeah. Pro or whatever your MacBook yeah. and look at the keyboard. Where would you want to put it? Right. So he sent me this proposal before he posted it, and he's like, you know, it should replace the tilde in the upper left hand yeah, yeah. corner of the keyboard. And I'm like, well, how am I going to type a tilde then? Tilde. I don't know. Yeah. But then I looked around and I'm like, oh, there's not really another obvious location. And it did seem like tilde is the least frequently used out of all the different punctuation marks and symbols and stuff. And then I suggested, well, why don't you look up the data? So he found a bunch of data and it turned out, yeah, tilde is like
the least
very used. Infrequently used.
Mm-hmm.
Developers probably are almost all the usage of it.
Right.
But, or people who want to say approximate. I use
the but tilde. But it's, I mean, look at the data from his post. It's yeah. very infrequently used compared to other stuff. So anyway,
you don't want to alienate developers.
So I would say the ask there is for like the Bitcoin community and or anyone who cares about this, look at the proposal, see if you can think of anything better.
I have one actually. There's a sign. It looks like an S and has a line going through it. Perhaps we can replace it like that.
Yeah, over the four. Yeah.
Right. Well, I mean, it's common to be able to put in like accents and stuff. Like if you want an E with an accent for some different language, you can like long press it or something. Sure. I almost wonder if the right way to do this is, you know, replace or make the dollar have like an extended version of it.
Mm. Yeah, but then it's not. I mean, we want first class citizen, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I already programmed my MacBook to just, if I hit B twice, it types the Bitcoin symbol. So. Right. Anyone can do that today. We want first class citizen though. So I think it needs to be on the keyboard, at worst case, a shift and then a key or something. But yeah, everyone should check out that proposal, see if we can improve it. And then we need to push computer makers, not just Apple, but all computer makers. And I think Matt's going to also work on some mocks for virtual keyboards cool. as well, because those are obviously much easier and faster to change. So the Apple keyboard, Google, et cetera, those like the default Android keyboard, adding a Bitcoin symbol to that because yeah. the Bitcoin symbol is rising in prominence. There's at least three situations where you'd want to type the Bitcoin B symbol now. One is when expressing units of Bitcoin for spending instead of sats,
mm-hmm.
visually show the Bitcoin B symbol. That's one.
Block already has that. It looks nice.
Blocked it. Yeah, with Square, we showed that. And there was zero confusion with the thousands of payments that were made at the conference. No one was confused.
Yeah. Right.
Totally fine. You just show the dollar value as well, which you already have to do to make so people understand it. It's totally fine.
Yeah.
Second is the naming for a BIP 353 human readable address. That's a mouthful, right? So normal people aren't going to say BIP 353 human readable address. So Bitcoin address, but with the B having the Bitcoin symbol versus mm-hmm. a regular B, that would be a BIP 353 human readable name. You can look at my X profile and see what mine is. It's moneyball at 12.cash. And you can receive Bitcoin through Bolt 12 or silent payments or any kind of method using that type of Bitcoin address. That's another place you'd have the Bitcoin symbol. And there's one more I'm not remembering offhand. But yes, so
places.
We should use that Bitcoin symbol anyway in products, because you don't have to type it once if you're putting it into a product. But for people to, you know, send it, you know, in messages and stuff and make it accessible, we want keyboards to support that.
And for the Bitcoin payment version of it, do you need to type that as part of it, or that's what shows up as an indicator of what you would type in the field? But it sounds like the field is itself more like an email address format.
Yeah. So like products could hard code in the Bitcoin B symbol, have a text box, and you type in moneyball at 12.cash or whatever the name is. That's how a product would naturally handle it. Mm-hmm. But if I were like messaging you, I could just share moneyball at 12.cash, but to be like formal and proper, I'd also want to have the Bitcoin B symbol in front of it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not like strictly required.
That's cool. One thing on your point with Apple, which I think relates to this keyboard thing as well. I unfortunately didn't get to stick around to speak with them yesterday. And so I don't know who it is without doxing them, but I was excited at BitDevs last night. So we do BitDevs here at Presidio Bitcoin, to see more Silicon Valley people. Like, sound like someone was working on, I guess passkeys or something in Apple that actually came to the event last night, which was cool. Someone else from Uber that was looking at using it in
and
fintech.
PayPal.
And PayPal. So one thing that I think would be really awesome, and I think we're in a really good position to do, is the more we can get, you know, we know there's, even if it's a small contingent, orange-pilled people in all of these big tech companies. We've had folks from NVIDIA, Google, would be great to get more of them. But, the more we can get those folks coming to events like BitDevs, maybe there's opportunities for us to do like sort of like, hey, I'm the Bitcoin guy in big tech events or something here. I think that, yeah,
how do you tune in? How do you tune into that? Is that like, can you sign up on a Presidio Bitcoin
just meetup.com
list, or just on meetup.com search for BitDevs?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's we could do a better job at marketing this though.
Yeah.
It's currently, if you go to meetup.com and join that group, then you'll get email notifications and stuff. Or you can follow, there's a Twitter account.
Right.
But we could do a better job. We meaning like both Presidio Bitcoin can do better and the SF Bit does.
Yeah.
Having said that, though, I mean, I 100% agree. We need to encourage more participation there. It's going really well, but
it's awesome,
let's get even more people, right?
Yeah.
I also think there's opportunity for a different type of regular event. So we have Bit Devs and Lit Devs right now for Lightning Devs. Both are quite technical meetups. So I like them, but you have to be pretty deep
in the weeds.
Like, you don't come, David, right? I mean, you have to be pretty in the weeds on the technical stuff to really enjoy it and participate and even learn if you're not super in the weeds. I think there's opportunity for one that's more like all three of our jam and a lot of product builders and thinkers in Silicon Valley, which is 100%. More, which is more vibe coding. It's more product thinking.
Yeah.
Business models, user applications. Like, why would users use this?
Yep.
That type of meetup.
I agree 100%.
We would all love that.
Idea. Yeah.
The three of us would love that. And tons of people in Silicon Valley would love that.
Yes.
So let's take an action.
I feel like
that's
feel like
huge, actually. This might be our new real breakthrough from Presidio Bitcoin.
I feel like the hackathon was kind of a fairly heavy to organize version of that.
Yeah.
But if we could almost take hackathon -, or lighter, or every 2 weeks version of that same energy.
Once a month, lightweight version that, you know. So let's follow up on that.
Like
I'm pretty sure we should do that. Yeah. So,
but everybody's a PM now, right?
All right, Alex, put that on my to do list.
No, seriously, that could actually like change the game.
Yeah,
I love it.
Yeah, it's good. On the conference, we've been called out.
Nice.
There was that there. I saw it on Twitter. So Matt Carallo says, "No save our wallets hat."
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Shillelagh.
So,
save our wallets.
Good call out.
Where's that?
I'm surprised Matt's watching the show.
Hey, so, Matt.
Let me tell you a little about Matt Carallo. Matt told me, when I told him we were going to create Presidio Bitcoin, he's like, "Steve, there's not even 10 people into Bitcoin in the Bay Area."
If you want to keep it that way, don't start Presidio Bitcoin.
So anyway, he motivated me to kick ass with Presidio Bitcoin. But thanks for watching, Matt. And Matt is absolutely right to call us out for not wearing. He gave me a hat I should be wearing right now. I did wear it on our PBJ last week.
Yeah.
But without that, I'll talk about it. So saveourwallets.org. That's the website. You can go there, learn more about it. It's about the BRCA bill that's been proposed in Congress. It's quite simple. I mean, I talked about it last show too, but I'll just summarize it again because it's important. One, it's protecting open source developers that they cannot be held legally liable for software they write and publish against, like, you know, being considered like an MSB or a money transmitter or something. Two is services or businesses that don't custody customers' funds also should not be considered, like, this bill, it's like a one-page bill. Like, yep. Anyone can read this and understand it. It just clarifies if you don't custody customer funds, you cannot be considered a money transmitter.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome.
And this matters for a lot of, any developer, but also many companies in this space. You know, we briefly mentioned Phoenix Wallet a few minutes ago. They exited the United States for about a year. A little over a year ago, and just re-entered. Why did they exit? Well, Samurai got sued, and Tornado Cash was being prosecuted. Both Tornado Cash and Samurai are being prosecuted, both of which are self-custody services. And so Phoenix got, you know, scared and exited.
Just like out of caution, right? They just
didn't want to go to prison.
Yeah. And it was
they didn't want
them.
25 years in prison.
Like a ton of people. Like, I mean, around that same time, Albi shut down their custodial wallet in the United States and everywhere. Kian decided to go all in on Onyx. Mm-hmm. That was all around the same time. All the companies freaked out, basically.
And so with the new administration, now Phoenix is back in the U.S. App Store. But, you know, the way the government works, like, in 3 years, Trump's no longer going to be president. There could be a new, there will be a new president. And that new administration.
Steve Bannon said otherwise.
Yeah, well. At some point.
And Elon's going to last 40 years, right?
You know, but an executive order doesn't have as much staying power as a bill, like law, passed by Congress. Yeah. So that's why this is important. It probably doesn't. Well, who knows? Right now is a wild card with the Trump administration, but who knows what will happen in the next few years? But definitely in 3 years, it could be a very different environment. So let's pass this bill now to just clarify what to me seems like the obvious, that, like, developers should not be prosecuted.
Writing code, you should not be responsible.
Writing code and publishing open source code, you should not be prosecuted. And if you're running a service that where you do not custody the funds, you shouldn't be held. You shouldn't be held to a standard of requiring an MSB license. And let me give you some examples of what those are. I mentioned Phoenix. Well, that's one. So they run a Lightning wallet, and they do have a Lightning node, which provides liquidity, but it doesn't custody customers' funds.
By not custodying, you mean Phoenix has open source software, you set up the wallet, and are they somehow, like, how are they not custodying your funds?
Because you're custodying your funds.
Okay, but I'm like, not running
on it. Let's say you have 200,000 Bitcoin in your balance, and so you have a Lightning channel with them. You have 200,000 Bitcoin on your side. They might have 100,000 Bitcoin on their side. So they custody their 100,000. You custody your 200,000. You have the private keys on your phone.
But so
they can't steal your money. You custody your phone.
They're a Lightning service provider. And so this whole idea, like, there, I guess, was a lack of clarity for all routing nodes. And by the way, I can say there was a chilling effect even in companies that are not public in my portfolio that also stopped running swap services, Lightning nodes, all kinds of things right around then. And so one thing that I would love to say, and I'm not sure if the bill would include this, but any Lightning node operator, like anyone that's doing routing, would that be included or no?
Yes.
That's
awesome. The way the language is written in Emmer's bill, the BRCA Act. Yeah. So I just want to make sure I explained it correctly, though. Like, with
Phoenix,
I understand.
If I have 200,000 Bitcoin in my Phoenix wallet and they have 100,000 Bitcoin, I don't think I understand what.
So when you open a channel, right? Yeah. So in the way the Lightning Network works, you have a channel which is a 2 of 2 multisig. And so basically we both commit, like, I have some Bitcoin on my side, like the abacus is the sort of analogy I always use. So let's say I have 200,000 beads on my side, 100,000 beads on your side. Every time we do a transaction back and forth, we're updating the state of that channel so that either of us could unilaterally exit if we write down to the base chain. So in this case with Phoenix, if they have 100,000 on their side, I have 200,000 on my side. If either of us published the pre-signed UTXO to say we're closing this channel, I would have 200,000 coins, you would have 100,000 coins. However, one could argue that, like, I can't use the Lightning Network without that channel. So that's where I think things were a little bit unclear.
Not really. If they disappeared, they turned their server off, you can still unilaterally exit.
Right. But so. I think the confusion was, I guess, because they, like, open a channel for you automatically? Or what was the confusion then?
There's nuance to a Lightning service provider. So like, for example, if you, to create a good user experience, often providers will have a just-in-time zero conf channel opening. So if you don't have any inbound liquidity on Lightning or you're a brand new user, then you don't want to have to wait an hour for that channel to be opened and have the it'd be confirmed on the blockchain for six blocks or whatever, right? That would be a horrible out-of-box experience. So Phoenix or whoever the wallet is can let you spend the money immediately, even though that channel is not confirmed on chain, and which creates a double spending opportunity. But if you're like a trusted brand, that's like a reasonable trade-off,
right?
That they're not going to steal from you in the next like 10 minutes to ruin their brand.
Right.
And the user experience is dramatically better. So there's like this 10-minute window of trust there. So that's like a gray area.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some other nuance too, if you get a bunch of lawyers in a room.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, but I mean,
those are gray areas with respect to how they would fall into or not fall into this new legislation.
No. The current
law,
the BSA Act and all subsequent laws.
Got it.
Guidelines.
But the new legislation.
Laws, regulations, clean. And guidelines. So you have to look at laws, then regulations, then guidelines by regulators. Those are like the three. And like you never get, or it's rare to get perfect clarity
mm-hmm.
on things. And right now there's not perfect clarity on this. That's exactly why this bill is valuable. But I just want to mention a few other examples beyond that. It extends far beyond Bitcoin, but all cryptocurrencies. If you're Coinbase is betting big on Base, their product Base, it too could become a regulatory target because they're the single sequencer in their zero knowledge proof rollup, right? So I could absolutely imagine a future administration, a future version of FinCEN or somewhere in the Treasury going after targeting them and saying, you are an MSB, you're unlicensed, you're in trouble. And then either they get, you know, fined, go to jail, or forced to KYC everyone, which destroys a lot of the use cases that are being used on Base right now. All of DeFi would be a target. So this is not just a self-custody Bitcoin issue. It's a much broader issue. So I think Coinbase needs to, and I know Coinbase supports this, I think they need to prioritize it in DC. I think A16Z, for all the portfolio companies, they need not just support it, but really proactively push this. And also high net worth people who donate to politicians that have a vested interest in Bitcoin or cryptocurrency at large need to be aware of this and take action.
To be fair on that, I understand it's great. We need allies like Coinbase. They spend a lot in lobbying stuff. But like, I mean, if they're the single sequencer for a chain that's effectively a MySQL database, like that does seem very different.
But they're not custodying funds.
Yeah, but like... I guess at the base level itself, no. I mean, that's a separate conversation, but great to build the tent. I would just say, at least in my mind, they're very different.
What I mean, another example is Spark.
Yeah.
From LightSpark.
That's in between.
So do you think that the government should require KYC and an MSB license for Spark?
I mean, I think the less you have to do that, the better. But I think it's very different to say what's custodial versus non-custodial. And I think it's certainly spectrum. Base seems extremely custodial to me, or at least Base is a centralized chain. Sorry, how about that? Non-custodial versus non-custodial.
I think it's definitely not custodial.
Yeah.
It's not custodying any funds.
It's non-custodial in the same way that eCash is non-custodial. So, but then there's like the question itself.
The thing you're teasing out, which is really important, is there's custodial, non-custodial, and it's not as simple as putting two buckets. It's a spectrum. I agree for sure. And then separate from that is this trust spectrum.
Yes.
And that's usually where, I don't know. I mean, both conversations are important because when it comes to the law and regulations, they tend to talk about the custody part.
Right.
So I guess my feelings on all this is that for regulations, they should not consider things that are not custodial.
Mm-hmm.
So pretty much anywhere on the spectrum of custodial that's not clearly custodial should not be considered an MSB.
Yep.
Separately, we have this trust spectrum, and it's very important to demand of services that they clearly communicate to their customers with transparency where they fall on that trust spectrum.
Yes.
And I think it's important to separate those two.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I was conflating those. So it's very good. It's very similar to the eCash debate where people say, is it custodial or non-custodial? Well, it's non-custodial, but you're trusting effectively a bank. And so that's a totally separate issue. Then there's the question of the privacy as well, which is its own like question of like, should the eCash mints be able to run and not know what customers are doing once they get their tokens? But
yeah,
anyways.
But that's... Yeah, there you go, Matt. We spent a good 10 minutes on that.
Yeah. So I think we should like talk about payments now, because like Lightning Network payments, to me, this is like the most exciting thing. This to me was the whole alpha from the conference. And actually we have a lot of discussion around this in the chat as well. So maybe to set the stage for this, the questions in the chat are around Square POS terminals and how that's going to be used. So maybe you can offer some feedback there, but I'd like to maybe set the stage on why this is such a big deal. So, for those who watched Miles Suter's talk, there's a lot of, you know, alpha and let's say history of what Block has done there, which I think is huge. But the TLDR is that, you know, Cash App obviously has had Lightning Network support for a long time. You know, a lot of people, I think, and this is something that I see a lot as well in the sort of like investor community, have no idea how important or what the potential of the Lightning Network is, because it's a private peer-to-peer network, right? So many people would say it's actually it's the largest, despite another network having the name the Onion Routing Network, Tor. Lightning Network is the largest today, from what everything I can tell, Onion Routed private peer-to-peer network. And so because of that, the way it works, you know, if Steve wants to route a payment to DK and he routes it through me, you know, it's impossible to know how many transactions I'm routing back and forth between them or other people in the network. And so, you know, even though there's only 4,100 or whatever it is, 4,500 Bitcoin that are locked up, old school Big B Bitcoin locked up in that network, the volume that's actually being done could be many orders of magnitude higher. So it's very difficult, as we've talked about on many PBJs in the past, to estimate how much payment volume in USD terms is actually flowing through the Lightning Network. But let's say it's probably, you know, much higher than people think, you know, maybe billions of dollars, maybe much more, we don't know. But the biggest alpha from this conference was with just the Lightning Network payments that Cash App has today and whatever else Block is doing internally, Miles announced that with 108 Bitcoin locked up, or I forgot the exact number, but around 100 Bitcoin locked up in the C equals routing node.
BTC.
Yeah, BTC in the routing node, big Bitcoin. This is one area we need a better lexicon to explain this, right? That they are doing around 10% yield Bitcoin on Bitcoin transactions. Now, this is a really big fucking deal. Like, to me, this was like the biggest thing in the conference. The reason for that is because we've discussed many times on this show, in the long run, if Bitcoin is going to scale to become global money for the world, it's going to scale in layers. You have Bitcoin as the base layer. Now you have a layer two on top of it, which is, you know, the money tubes, as Lalu calls it, the railroads, as I've sort of called it over time, to ship those little units of Bitcoin around the world at the speed of light, which, by the way, shout out to Block for their LSP name, which I love. And it struck me a couple months ago, C equals. These guys are thinking a lot about moving money at the speed of light. And so what that means is that if I can now take some Bitcoin, and I can lock that up in the two of two multisig like we were just discussing, I am now taking the Bitcoin that I could have had in cold storage. I am giving up some of the opportunity costs of that Bitcoin. So I'm putting it in these channels. But as long as I have credible hot wallet risk management, then it's risk-free. And I'm putting that Bitcoin in there and I can start now by using the liquidity, generate a Bitcoin on Bitcoin yield. And as we discussed, if you can't explain the yield very simply, you are the yield. So all of DeFi, you're probably the yield. Most lending, you are the yield. But here, you are routing and you can explain exactly where that yield comes from. This is such a big deal because if Cash App and Block are getting 10% yield, Bitcoin on Bitcoin returns, that would be double or more what you can get from treasuries right now in Bitcoin terms. Now, there's a lot of caveats, and this is what we should discuss. Does that scale? Does Block, by virtue of having tens of millions of users sort of locked up, forced to use liquidity with Cash App, you know, are they the only node in this position? There's a lot of nuance here, but the high level takeaway is you can at least, as an investor, if there's investors listening to this podcast or maybe later stage, you can see the potential of what could come on the Lightning Network, which is risk-free rate of return, denominated in Bitcoin that is greater than what you can get in traditional lending and treasury markets, that's a big deal.
Do you think those will ever be offered to third-party investors? Because I would guess in the case of the block stat that we heard, it's under a very specific set of circumstances, like you mentioned, right? They're already kind of Cash App and big routing node and stuff. Do you think, like, so I've mentioned that concept to a few people over the last week, and they're like, how do I get involved?
I can speak.
Okay. Yeah.
Let me first, for years, I've, like, very simple math can show you the potential for very high yields or annualized returns from Lightning routing node, because I saw some responses to this saying like, oh, that's great for, you know, this business getting 10%, but it's horrible for people paying high fees. And that's not true, mm-hmm. because it's not like if you put a Bitcoin into this onto a Lightning node, it's not like it gets used once a year.
Right.
You can facilitate many payments per year. And in fact, if you just do one payment per day and then take, and then only charge, 0.1% fee on that mm-hmm. node, so a small fee, then, you can take 1.001 to the 365th power and get a sense for what kind of annualized return you get. And what if you can do it? What if that Bitcoin can be used more than once per day? I mean, in theory, like, payments only take 1 second.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
like the ceiling here is to turn over your capital every few seconds.
Yeah.
And keep doing that over and over again. take a tiny percentage fee, and then like
good for the user. Compound it super efficient.
Thousands and thousands of times in a year, it's a very high percentage. So the potential is immense. Now, of course, if someone's making thousands of percent return, what happens? There's new entrants.
There's competition.
Markets. There's new entrants. It drives those down.
Unless there are network effects to what allows that to be created.
It's to a point, but unless it gets so abusive, then all of a sudden the network.
It's a good topic to get into what would be the scaling there but I think what has going for it is it's a very permissionless network. Mm-hmm. It's not like trying to enter the Visa network and competing or something. So
I mean, I can't just spin one up today and start making 10% of my own. I need to.
We'll get into that. Okay. You can absolutely spin one up on your own and make fees right now, earn fees for sure.
And if you're very,
but I'll get into the 10% and like whether you could do that. And the answer is yes, but with an asterisk.
Okay.
How much time and coins you got
now? So first of all, the ceiling for returns is very high, and then the only thing that brings it down is competition. But it's always been theoretically possible to make huge returns. So on one hand, I'm not surprised at all, but it's like fantastic to actually see this concrete in real world with a pretty sizable node. It's like a top. It was top five. I think I saw it's number seven today, but it's one of the it's definitely a top 10 node in the network. And I know BitRefill also. Responded after Block announced that with their own, they calculated their own returns, and they said they're getting 3.5% on their node, which is also fantastic.
Which is still great, yeah.
So, frankly, like if we fast forward to a world where there's competition and it drives it down, I think it's Nick Bhatia, like six years ago, talked about the new LIBOR, the new like risk free rate would be the Lightning Network. I totally agree with him. I think you do as well, Max.
Big time.
And I don't know what that's going to be. I think that what it gets driven to is you are taking a security risk because you can take your coins out of cold storage and you have to put them in a hot wallet. Now, you can make it a warm wallet by putting it in a trusted execution environment, which we talked about a little bit before, and you can certainly harden it, but it's never going to be the same security profile as cold storage. So you're taking a little bit of security risk, and there's just like operational hassle and overhead and things like that. So you need a return for that, but it might be 1% or something, right? And the reality is, once Bitcoin's widespread, a 1% return on your Bitcoin is phenomenal. I mean, this, because it's not like a 1% return on fiat money that's inflating. This is a deflationary currency where you name another asset where you earn a yield and you get a self custody it.
Like, and again, I can't
name one. I don't think there is one.
Your returns are in Bitcoin. So you're getting this hard asset paid back in this hard asset, which I think is a big deal.
So that's very unique. So even if it's 1%, that would be an incredible long-term outcome. Let's get into the...
But that's all very long-term, right? Like, because, you know, I'm not a skeptic about this. I'm actually a believer in these ideas. But if you were to be more skeptical, you might say, why don't I just generate 10% yield on, you know, some MicroStrategy preferred offering, and I'll just, you know, harvest that in every quarter, and then I'll buy Bitcoin with that yield. Like, how is this different?
Sorry, I was looking at Jimmy's response. Can you repeat what...
Yes,
we'll respond to Jimmy in a second, but can you repeat what you said?
I think that... Yeah, go ahead.
Well, so basically, because I think this actually could be... We still have to do our full show on just like, what does the world look like on a Bitcoin standard, right? And so high level, we're going to talk more about MicroStrategy because the two things I've been going very, very deep on, and some context, I'm writing my own LLP update right now. So I'm extremely deep in the weeds on this, is in the future, there will basically, we're repricing the whole world in Bitcoin. That's like, if you zoom out, that's the big takeaway. And so there are going to always be different forms of yield and different forms of arbitrage. Now it's hard to know what that's going to be at the steady state. And so that could be a decade out, it could be 50 years out. Who knows? And to DK's question is, why don't I use one of these new Microsoft instruments like Strike or Stride, which, by the way, there's so much to say about that as well. Get 10%
paid in Bitcoin. But that's not self-custody. I mean, I'm not saying don't use it, but that's clearly a big difference.
Yeah, I guess like if you were trying to pitch somebody on the idea, like I feel like 50 years from now, when Lightning is the risk-free rate of return, it makes perfect sense. But today, if somebody's just being like, you know, opportunistic kind of, I just want like the best return, why not take 10% with no self-custody and then use that to buy Bitcoin and put in full self-custody?
Because you're trusting Michael Saylor, you're trusting this company, you're trusting their financial engineering innovation. It's like, why invest in bonds when you can invest in stocks? Or I mean, it's just like
exactly.
Apples to oranges.
The thing is like different people and different companies have different knowledge sets, they have different risk appetites, they have different mandates. Like, that's a great way of saying this. Like, why doesn't everyone just buy Bitcoin? Why would you ever do Stride or MicroStrategy in the first place? Well, I mean, this is the whole thesis of Saylor's. He's repricing the bond market as we speak because there are, as we've talked about, $300 trillion sitting in bonds that can't buy Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. Because there are, like we talked about with, you know, equities, money that can't buy Bitcoin. And for the individual, I think it's also very important. I would certainly not recommend, if someone is a total noob hearing this, being like, hey, I'm going to take my life savings, spin up a Lightning node, let's fucking go, baby, 10%. Like, that's not going to happen. Like, there's a lot of asterisks. But I think another reason that you would start doing this today, if you're a company like Block, or maybe an investor who's trying to think about how do I make a lot of money in the long run, is you would start building these nodes and operational expertise and, frankly, position in the network. Well, really, we'd start doing it 5 years ago. But second best time to do it would be today. And so that's kind of always, you know, my thesis is if you zoom out on a long enough time horizon, what I've been doing at HiveMind nonstop for the last 5 years is buy equity in the grand central nodes that are routed. And so those companies like Block are looking to the long run, which is, you know, if we can generate anywhere near 10%, 3%, whatever, BTC on BTC returns, risk-free, and we own that dominant position, to your point, like, yes, it's an open network, but there always still will be network effects. Then that's a great position to start building today. But if you're like a normie that just wants 10%, yeah, like MicroStrategy is a great move.
Let's get into that. We've said we're going to talk about it three times now, but like, can everyone earn 10%? What are the asterisks behind that?
Because you mentioned bit refill at 3.5%.
Yeah, so that, why isn't that 10%?
Why is that
10%? And if you spun up a Lightning node right now and just put it in the network,
how much would you get?
Probably like 0.5% is what you'd get probably.
Okay.
That would be my guess. Yeah. So why the difference? So I'll start by just describing Block's special circumstance, but also it's not specific to Block. So, and then this gets into all kinds of like opportunities for wallets. And then also, hold on.
We have a superstar in the chat.
Well, also, before we lose Jimmy's message, I wouldn't say investing in Lightning Round is risk-free though. I'm very doubtful anyone can make 10% yield. Yeah, okay, we're going to get into that.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think we covered the risk. It's not literally risk-free because of the reasons I said, security and operation overhead. So you need to get compensated for that. And then we're going to talk about the 10%.
Let's touch on the risk before we jump in that 10%. And by the way, we've got Nick Slaney, who actually built out the SQL nodes at Block in the chat, which is pretty fucking awesome. Shout out to Nick. He was one of the early people that saw this years ago as well. But how much risk is it really? Because I have messaged some, let's say, exchange and like heavy node operators privately. Because I'm saying, what's your take? How much of this is real? How much of this is like a little bit of overhype? And to be fair, because I know I can get very bullish. I know we all can. There was some mixed reactions saying like, yes, like, you know, there's a lot of payment volume we need to bring to the network to scale this. We'll talk more about that. But I was surprised to hear, and just being fair in my assessment, they were more concerned about hot wallet risk than I realized. So I don't know, you know, maybe from your perception, or maybe Nick, and I don't know what you can share from Block's perspective, how low can you theoretically get that hot wallet risk today?
Yeah. So today, I think most, if not all, actually, Async has done some good work here. So most Lightning nodes, though, are pure hot wallets.
Yes.
So there's a server, it's running LND or some Lightning implementation, and the keys are like on that server. So it's typically has quite a few people have access to it. It could be hacked. And then all the money could be that at least it's on their side of the channels could be drained. So that's I don't think it's like totally insane risk at this maturity level of Lightning Network, but it's not where we want to be at the end state. So yes. Your question is like, well, how much better can we make it? Well, Spiral invested in funded a project called VLS, Validating Lightning Signer, over 4 years ago, which is a Lightning state machine that can run in a trusted execution environment.
Mm-hmm.
And Lightning is a complicated beast. This narrows down the scope of what is needed for a very simple Lightning signer.
Mm-hmm.
You need the keys, you need the signing software. You also, unfortunately, need to have the entire Lightning state machine or the most of the Lightning state machine because you don't want to blind sign.
Mm-hmm.
If you're signing blindly, meaning you have no, all you're just given this transaction to sign and you don't know anything else about it, well, then an attacker can just hand you a transaction as well. So you need to have a lot of policies to make sure that, oh, this is something I want to sign.
Right.
So it's still relatively complicated, but it does have a reduced attack surface. Unfortunately, that project, I don't think it's deployed in any TEs yet.
Mm.
So there's a maturity there.
Is it just that?
Because I think Lightning's just immature.
Okay. But the tech, there's not
much money in Lightning. Even Block, one of the major nodes, 100 BTC.
Yeah, it's not a big deal.
I mean, it's like in some contexts, it's a lot, but it's not really that much money. It's like, I mean, Block has 8,500 BTC in their treasury. So obviously, we don't want to lose the 100 BTC, but if we did, it's not like doesn't devastate the company or something. Right. So
is the tech ready though? So let's say Block wanted to roll this out tomorrow. Like, is the project in a state where like that's realistic?
It's certainly ready for like integration and testing, and maybe there's some like early adopter bugs that need to be worked out. Yeah. But yes, and then even LDK could be used because LDK is very modular, and you can break out the pieces you need from LDK. And the nice thing with LDK is there's a lot of contributors to it, and it is used in production in many different environments. So at this point, I mean, 4 years later, like either of those projects are candidates for doing that in hard. And so you'd wind up in a situation. So how secure is it? Well, then the keys are in a trusted execution environment. And you can really limit the access to who can update like the firmware on that. You can even do the independently verifiable. Making sure the binaries that are running in that T are what the services has open sourced.
Cool.
So you can get it pretty secure.
Yeah.
You can never achieve cold storage level, but it can be quite secure. So I absolutely see this is the direction the industry will head, and it will reduce the security risk substantially. You'll still need a premium because otherwise, why would you even want to take? I mean, you're still taking a risk. I mean, why bring your coins out of cold storage if you get 0% return?
Right.
And why spend any time on it? Why operate a business? Why like run these servers? So there clearly needs to be a non-zero yield, but I think it can be relatively thin and worthwhile.
Yeah.
Yeah. But let's get to the 10% and like who can earn it, who can't. So with Block, and also you, what if, I mean, let me start with the question. What if Block, instead of having 100 BTC, I just said they have, Block has like 8,500 BTC in the treasury. Why not, if you get 10% yield, why not put all of it into this, right? Well, if you did that, the yield's going to plummet. Because and actually someone criticized calling it yield, and they might be right. Because usually with a yield,
it scales.
It scales. Like, yeah. You know, if I get 5% yield on a CD, well, I can put $100,000 into it or $200,000. I can keep putting more money in and I still get the 5% yield. That's not the case here. So maybe yield is actually the wrong term.
That's a good point.
Yeah. I'd be totally fine changing the terms. I think it's definitely true. If Block put 8,500 BTC into this, it wouldn't be 10% return. It'd be under 1%. So it scales with usage of Lightning. So the more payments done by people, then it does scale. Absolutely scales. So the incentive for everyone is to create great products that induce people to make payments. Then they pay tiny little fees that add up.
Right.
That's the lever, right? Now, what's the difference between like Block earning fees versus just like DK spinning up a node? Block is in an advantageous position because being on the edge of the network versus the middle, they are at the source of all these payments. And specifically, Block Cash App customers tend to withdraw a lot more than they deposit. And what that does is it creates a lot of inbound liquidity that then the Sequel node can sell.
Sell, yeah.
Because for people not familiar with how Light Network works, Max explained it a little bit earlier with the Abacus, but if I open a channel to David, I can do that, you know, as an action I can take, but I have outbound liquidity when I do that, meaning I have the Bitcoin on my side of the channel and you have zero. So I can't receive any Bitcoin, and you can receive as much Bitcoin in that channel as I put into the channel. So if I want inbound liquidity, I have to convince you or someone else to open a channel to me.
Right.
And because that's a financial opportunity cost for you to put Bitcoin in that channel, you're going to want a fee, or you need some incentive to do that with me. So if the C equals routing node gets a lot of the Cash App traffic, not all, but I mean, there's other nodes that Cash App uses too, but a lot of the Cash App traffic goes through the C equals Lightning node, and it just creates a dynamic where they can sell, or basically they're rebalancing their channels, and they are in the strong position of giving others inbound liquidity and being paid for it. So a lot of that yield is from that. And I don't know the exact numbers, but it might explain most or all the difference between Bit Refills 3.5% and Block's approximately 10%.
Do they have the opposite type of business, the Bit Refill business?
Merchant. Yeah. So I think
that's a really good point.
And then,
so how would that scale them for Block? Because if Block is now turning on the merchant business to receive, so that liquidity could be much less valuable. So Cash App is like much better. A wallet business where I'm spending, that's where the real yield comes.
Yes. So, which is why I think a really interesting topic for us is like, there's three value creators here. First of all, an LSP, which is this edge Lightning node, which is kind of what Sequel is acting as in this situation. That's where the actual revenue is generated. So obviously those actors in the space can generate, they're the ones generating the revenue.
And shout out to Roy from Breeze, who coined that term.
So they're
service provider.
Yep. So they're needed. The wallet, of course, is needed because human beings install the wallet, or AI could use the wallet, yeah. Right? But I mean, so that's an important actor. But also applications are. Because imagine David's the LSP, you're the wallet, and I'm the application. If I happen to create the most awesome application that everyone's using, who has the power? I have the power because I can switch to a different wallet. I can switch away from, I can switch to a different LSP. I can run my own LSP. Likewise, though, if you have the wallet that 200 million people install, then you have a lot of power. And if you have an LSP that's like super high quality and reliable and has great liquidity, then people, the wallets are attracted to you, right? So each of those actors add value, and can increase their power just by being high quality and popular. And then the revenue generated by the LSP can be shared. There can be revenue sharing agreements.
Do you think, so this is a very, very interesting point. And to be clear, I don't think anyone knows the answer to like these breakdowns. These are going to be empirical like percentages we can say for each of the different, you know, relative actors. That's a good way of breaking down. Let's say I'm an app that gets crazy popular in Lightning Network. So this week we talked about in our chat, Albie released Ellen Fly, which is a vibe coding thing. It's really super cool. They were able to one-shot an app where people are buying lottery tickets with Lightning. And every time you buy more lottery tickets, you add time to the amount that the, basically it, you buy more time for the lottery to run. So it's a really cool dynamic. I like it a lot. So in that case, let's say the lottery app is, let's say Albie, because they're doing everything via Nostr Wallet Connect. They're not, they actually do run a node, but let's just say for the purposes of this, they're not running a node at all. So they have an app that's super popular, but you have to connect with them via Nostr Wallet Connect. So you have a different wallet and a different, you know, I don't know, I guess LSP that they're connecting to do the routing. Are you still suggesting though that, like, how do you think the fees will break down in that world? Like, because they own the app that's popular, they'll be able to, even if they're not running the LSP.
When you say app, you mean the wallet or an app? Like, let's take
the app.
Yes. Well, there's another party here whoever created that app.
But here, let's use Stacker News as an example.
Sure, because
we all know it.
Yeah.
Stacker News, let's say it blows up and it's like an incredibly popular application.
Yes.
And let's just hypothetically say all the Stacker News users use Albie as the wallet.
Sure.
And then let's say, you know, Olympus is the LSP. Right? These are all three real things today.
Yep.
And actually, literally, that is it's not 100% market share yet, but like, people are doing that today, that combo. But let's just say that it explodes in popularity. Then, you know, each Olympus, Albie, and Stacker News are all providing value.
Yes.
They all, if we're the agents for each of those three and we're negotiating with each other, like we can all make arguments about like, okay, Stacker News should get a share and Albie should get a share and Olympus should get a share. And so, you know, it's a negotiation, but like you're not going to exit the room with 0% for any of those parties.
Right.
What's your best guess in that specific example of how, let's say there's 10% yield in that whole scenario, how that gets split? It's hard to say, I know.
Well, it really is hard. I mean, so we as Bitcoiners want a lot of LSPs. We want a lot of wallets.
And a lot of apps.
Apps, right? But let's say I'm the Stacker News agent.
Yeah.
And let's say it is the killer app. It is the reason why everyone's doing Bitcoin payments initially. And there's many wallets and many LSPs. Well, then Stacker News is going to get the lion's share of the revenue, I'd think.
Yeah.
Because I'll just be like, I'll move to another wallet. Yeah. I'll build my own. I'm already making millions. I'll just build my own wallet. I'll build my own LSP, right?
So
whereas if there's thousands of applications that are popular,
right,
and then you have the dominant wallet with like 200 million users, then the wallet is going to have a lot of power and get the lion's share of that 10%.
I'm just realizing, I mean, so many things are running through my head. This is such a fucking good conversation. My first thought is, you know, who's going to kill it in this is going to be Facebook. If they integrate a Lightning wallet into WhatsApp and perhaps LightSpark will be the beneficiary there, as you've predicted in the past.
And if they find a way to motivate people to do payments
via WhatsApp,
then they'll have earned it.
Yeah.
I wish them luck. I hope they do that. Right. But it's also possible they just integrate it and no one uses the payments as well.
Yeah.
Just if all they do is just add payment option, it may or may not work.
You have to be clever with that. So a bunch of questions on that. The first one though, you had a tweet, which I thought was great, succinct, pithy, which is LSP is the business model or something to that effect. But what I'm actually hearing you say now is LSP is a business model, but the real business model is still going to be like, if I'm putting on just my investor hat, like, yes, you know, if I have a bunch of users, I could make money on LSP, or I could say, you know what? No, I'm just going to focus on building the absolute best app as long as there's enough LSPs. So would you reframe that then as Lightning usage? I don't know. How would you reframe that?
I mean, my tweet was like five words or whatever.
Yeah,
so like
it's a tweet.
It's pithy, yeah. But I mean, the more nuance to it. So, well, first of all, maybe yield is the wrong word.
Okay, yeah, I agree.
Cool. Pick a different word. The substance.
Returns,
the same.
Whatever.
Returns. Secondly, the 10%, I do think that comes down over time for the reasons we said. So bear that. But in early, like the
next. Does it though? Because we're going to have so much more usage too.
Well, I mean, Yes, I think it will. I mean, the next 5 years, who knows? I mean, like there could be fat margins. It's like because no one's in the space, and the early movers will reap a lot of profits early on. But the long term, yes, I think it comes down for the reasons we said earlier. Like competition will just keep entering,
right?
and there's you can't really there's not a lot of moat there. I don't think if there's literally 10% earnings, then like that. So let's say there's 10% earnings. Let's say six goes to Stacker News, 2 to Albee, 2 to LSPs. Well, then the LSPs are going to just keep entering and squeeze the LSP to zero.
Yeah.
And then more and more wallets enter and squeeze the wallet to zero, right? And then
to do a competitor to Stacker News in that.
I think
case,
that
right?
yield does come down to, I don't know what, 3% or whatever.
This is a fundamental question.
So my view, but I still think this is like exciting. So wallet developers, the question the entire time I've been in the space is like, what's the business model for a wallet? There's never been a great business model for a wallet. The only good business model in the space are like
exchanges,
like gambling casino exchange or mining chips. That's about
maybe
it.
Maybe loans.
Well, to date though, that's the two business models that have generated profit.
I would say there's two others, just HODL and securitization. But that's
just HODL is not like a, you don't VC. You don't.
It's not revenue generating. It's just asset growth.
Yeah. So, right. In the future, there's lots of potential. But so, I guess my current view, though, if you're building a wallet, is that you should be more excited about your potential.
Yes.
Because I think the base business model is this lightning earnings or yield or whatever. That's like a base. Mm-hmm. It's maybe not what you ultimately aspire to. Like you want to do more and bigger and higher growth than that. But it's a nice revenue stream as a baseline to keep your product and your team sustained.
Right.
Then you can layer on. And I know 1031 tweeted back at me they said nope to this. But I think we're in agreement. I mean, I said like, well, okay, what models are you imagining for a wallet? And they said loans.
It's value add services, yeah.
And I forget that maybe inheritance and a few other value-added services. I agree with their whole list. Absolutely. Yeah. We are, Lava's doing loans and
of course.
So of course, but you can create a wallet without those things and have at least a lifestyle business as long as you have users that are spending money. And then you can some wallets will layer on one of those services. Some will layer on all the services. Some will fail. Some will succeed. But the baseline revenue stream, it can be this the lightning earning fees. And again, you can be buy and sell Bitcoin is another value added service that 1031 mentioned. Agreed. And also, again, getting back to why does Cash App do so well? Well, a lot of people buy Bitcoin on Cash App. And why do they have like they have way more withdrawals than deposits. And it's because people go to Cash App, they buy Bitcoin, and then they go spend it.
Yeah.
Right? And they do that. A lot more people do that than they have people depositing their Bitcoin towards Cash App. So if you create a wallet and you have buying ability in it, and you get it for whatever reason, you're successful, you get popularity, you're going to be in a very advantageous position on the Lightning Network.
Okay, I want to take one step back, and maybe this will be something we go out even deeper on our show of what does the future look like on the Bitcoin standard. But I want to like just for a minute, first principles, whatever, try and figure out what does the Lightning Network reference rate look like in the long run? Because to your point, you said, okay, if there's 10% today, that can't last because there's going to be a lot more competition. Yes. And there's going to be a lot more competition to create new volume, right? And because imagine with AI is using this and all the stuff we talked about in the show, like there can be so many more business models. There's micropayments. DK and I were messaging yesterday about like how excited I am with some of this Ellen Fly stuff and the ability to have micropayments online, which we haven't had before, totally new business models. So the way I'm thinking about this, and I'm just going off the cuff here, so please tell me if you guys have something different. The true risk-free rate of return, like the real treasury rate in the world, is going to be the rate of innovation for society at large, true innovation, because you'll always be competition to bring margins down. Capitalism, beautiful, free markets, beautiful. But there will always also be this other force of like, yes, I could be routing for these guys over here, the Stacker News app. There's then going to be like, I don't know, so many new apps, like trillions of new apps and AI apps that are coming in. And now that's sucking some of the liquidity away from Stacker News. Because remember, Bitcoin is always scarce. The routing nodes are scarce. And so now the yields can rise again because there's new innovation. Is that a fair way of thinking about it? What do you guys think? The LNRR, the rate of return, is like a reflection of society's innovation.
Well, isn't that, I mean, we've said before, and I think we agree, like ultimately the purchasing power growth of Bitcoin is a function of GDP.
Yes.
And GDP is a function of innovation.
So how do you think those two things relate? Because what we've said in the past, which I also agree with, is the rate of growth of Bitcoin. So if I just hold Bitcoin, HODL, I never spend my Bitcoin, it goes up. The rate of GDP growth for whole all of society. Is that the same as the Lightning Network routing rate? Or how do you think those two things are related?
Let's say we get to that, fast forward to that future, and let's say GDP grows at 4% or whatever.
Whatever,
it doesn't really matter, but just call it 4. Then I would say if you just hold Bitcoin in cold storage and do nothing else with it,
you get 4%.
You get your purchasing power increases 4% annually.
Yeah.
If I then put it to work in the Lightning Network, that might boost that an additional 1% or 2%.
Right.
So then I'd be increasing my purchasing power by 6%.
Totally. And you're getting paid for the risk putting in or the opportunity cost of supplying liquidity. But my point is, what do we think that percentage is going to be like? So the 4% is the rate of GDP growth. The like sort of stable point, maybe there is not a stable point. It really does reflect how society shifts over time. What is that rate for the Lightning Network?
Well, I think it has to reflect security risk and operational overhead. But I think that can be long-term, very small, like something like 1%. However, something I was thinking about as we're talking on this show, that's maybe like an average or a baseline.
Right.
But let's say Stacker News blows up or Facebook does something amazing or there's some killer app that has a lot of usage. They could generate much higher fees because they can just charge more. And because people love the service, they're willing to pay more.
Right.
So if I'm using like, you know, Joe Schmo's wallet just normally in trying to go pay it,
it's a great
Steak and Shake or whatever, you know, maybe there's not, I'm willing to pay less fees there. But if I'm playing the latest, you know, VR game or something or the super sexy app or whatever, like I'm willing to pay more, right? So if you generate tremendous value in an application, that app plus whatever wallets and LSPs are being used can charge higher fees.
I mean,
so even long term, it could be 5% or in certain circumstances. So the real TLDR here is just like if you generate a lot of customer value and people use it a lot, money is there to be had.
Yeah, which I think is actually a great point, is focus on how are you creating value, not how are you capturing it. And I think sort of in our world today, where everybody's focused on how do I capture value? How much am I getting paid? What am I making? What's my yield? Instead of what am I contributing? And I think if you start with what am I contributing, then good things can happen and you actually have more of a position to make sure good things happen if you know what you're contributing. But if you're focused, I think it's a whole fiat mindset to be focused on what am I making, what am I capturing. And I have actually a good friend who came in and we were talking about this and we're talking about like, what does that future look like when, you know, we're on that Bitcoin standard? And I think a lot of assumptions are sort of, we're going to take what we currently do with US dollars and flip Bitcoin in instead, and then everything else kind of works the same. And I think it's a radical reinvention of every layer of society if you do this. Like if Bitcoin is going to be an important foundational part of how society works, I think it's you kind of have to rebuild everything else on top of that. You can't just swap it out with the dollar, right? And so what does investment look like? What does venture capital look like?
Right.
What does technology development look like? You know, how does free speech work? How do our tools get built? Do they get built by us or by AIs primarily? Like all of these questions. So like, what is a 4%? 4% may sound unexciting when you think about like, oh, look at all these other things I can do in the fiat world. But when you think about 4% in that replaced Bitcoin world, everything's been reinvented. 4% may be great. And an extra 1% on top of that may be an amazing kicker that you couldn't even imagine. Today, it just sounds like, whatever, 1%, right?
And getting back to your question, David, whether, you know, can you just spin up a Lightning node and compete and get 10% or compete with Cash App? So my answer then, and I'll explain why, yes or no. No, if you just literally spin up a Lightning node and open a few channels, no, you're not. But you're a vibe coder, right? And you also, you're a product thinker, you're a good ideas guy, you can create value. So if you create a super compelling application where people are making Bitcoin payments, then yes, you could get something like 10% because you'll have a lot of people using your product. They'll be doing a lot of Bitcoin payments, and that will be a reason for earning high fees. So I think you and people like yourself absolutely can earn those types of returns.
Yeah. And maybe some would quibble. It's like, it's not, again, it's not like a just pure yield. It's also like, it's like kind of like in a way, like the payment processing fee almost, like you're getting a cut for sending payments. So I think that gets into more of just like, I don't know, the words and how you wish to partition things. But I actually want to address Nick said a couple of things. But before we do that, I want to be very clear as I'm thinking about current business models. And you guys may have more context on this than me. Again, it's just, I don't know why it's just like hitting like a ton of bricks that like Facebook with WhatsApp is so well positioned because the whole fucking world uses WhatsApp. Have they monetized WhatsApp in any way, shape, or form? Because they bought it for like what, $14 billion, or was it $40 billion? Some huge amount of money.
18 or 20.
Yeah, but that was also in like dollars from from 10 years ago.
So they put all that in Bitcoin.
I know. So regardless, point is they paid a tremendous amount of money for this extremely popular messaging app, which in theory is encrypted. I think it's provably encrypted. I don't know how much I trust that, but like, let's just say for a minute it is. So that means it's, you can't really like serve people ads in there.
It's for data. I think they have all the metadata available for the ad network.
So some of the metadata is probably very viable for the ad network. But in terms of if you're like just trying to monetize that directly or monetize a messaging app or Signal or any messaging app direct, oh my God, this is making me so much more bullish on these messaging apps because, and I'm assuming this is why it's all hitting me now. David Marcus was at Messenger, then tried to build Libra. Obviously, that didn't work. Now he's building Lightspark. You made the...
Or did I already talk about this in the film? Was it a new... We need to go look at our New Year's...
Your prediction was fine.
Did I include that prediction?
So your prediction
was... Prediction?
Yeah, but say it again.
Meta will buy Lightspark? Or was it just Meta will partner with Lightspark?
No, yeah, somebody made that prediction.
Okay. So they're going to buy them, and I love the prediction.
Either one. Okay. I can see.
But so, and I give you tons of credit for that because it's been sitting in my brain circulating all that time. You said it 6 months ago, like hat tip to Steve. But now it's in real time coming forward for me like, oh my God, they can turn up the monetization if they buy them or partner, whatever they end up doing, a lot on these assets. And so can Signal. And so can anyone that owns the user where they are daily, which is also such a beautiful fucking thing. And maybe this is what Jack was saying when he talks about, you know, we would have had a different business model with Twitter if we had had micropayments back then. Maybe this is actually the death of all of our horrible, disgusting social media and advertising business models, because now if you own the user privately and their chat app is their wallet app, which could all be happening over Nostr or whatever else we're talking about, then now you can just monetize via the LSP and the routing, and the horrors of advertising can become radically reduced.
If they find ways,
let's go.
But still, you have to, like, what? Okay.
Yes.
You know, why are people doing Bitcoin payments? I mean, you still have to answer that. I'm bullish as well, but it's not as simple as just adding Bitcoin payments to WhatsApp.
You need use cases.
Need the use cases, but you get my point. If you zoom out, assuming we find reasons that you would want to make a payment, which I think we can definitely figure out, then now we have a credible business model for all of these old world social media companies to make incredible revenues without just treating us all as capital.
I think we also have a lot of new technology, like the stuff Jeff G is working on. Yes. Like private messaging tools that kind of work in a Nostr adjacent way. I think those kinds of things, it could show, you know, thousand flowers bloom. Nick say an idea?
No.
Keep going. We can.
I was just saying, I think having, you know, existing messengers could add it, but also we have all kinds of new tools, new networks that are being formed around protocols that are not platforms. Like those could actually be some of the big winners because the use cases emerge and, you know, they're Bitcoin native type, you know, or Bitcoin adjacent experiences. So like, I don't think we need to wait or rely on the, you know, WhatsApp to make a decision or even Signal to make a decision. But I think we just need those apps to get built that drive the use case.
We have 11 minutes left.
Yep.
Let's not rug pull people on Circle IPO. Can we transition to that?
Yes, but one last thing I just want to understand from Nick, because this is very interesting. I mean, it says C equals capitalize on, well, I think he said this in the path before, that merchant services are very viable, but to balance the channels naturally. So that's interesting to me that if you have both with them in block, it's
well, that's true, but then you lose out on the ability to earn revenue off that. But anyway, I'll chat with Nick. Yeah, Nick knows more than I do about this stuff, so he's probably right.
All right, let's not rug.
All right, well, Circle IPO'd, and the IPO performance has been phenomenal the last 2 days. Before the show I checked, it's like valued at $23 billion and change.
Jesus.
I mean, just for comps, you know, it's something like 60% the value of Block and 40% the value of Coinbase or whatever, right? So, you know, why would it be valued that much? Well, it's got, I mean, we can look at Tether as well. You know, Tether's much bigger, and I don't know what they're valued at, but, you know, it seems like they would be valued at like $100 billion or more.
More.
Probably more. There's $61 billion in USDC issued. At 5% treasury yields, that's $3 billion, I believe, something like $3 billion of profit per year just by having this money sit in the bank. Now, there's a partnership with Coinbase, and then Circle also does partnerships with other companies as well. So they don't necessarily get to keep all that money, but there's a lot of money generated from that $61 billion. That $61 billion has doubled in the past year, and by anyone's estimate, stablecoins are just going to continue to skyrocket. So it growing to like $1 trillion seems, you know, inevitable, or like
for stablecoins to
be stablecoins in general, yeah, almost inevitable that it'll be trillions. And then USDC is like the number two player. And you can make an argument that they'll become the dominant player. We'll talk a little bit about that because we've heard other things. You know, we've heard other people say that you know, Tether's already won. You know, if I believe the investment thesis here is that stablecoins, multi-$1 trillion, USDC will at least be the number two player, if not become the number one player and capture $1 trillion plus of that. And then just the treasury yields alone, I mean, you just like sit on the beach and literally do nothing, basically. Although, apologies to Alex. Alex worked there 2 years and did sales. So there's a few people that are needed. But basically, it's not that hard you don't need a lot of people at that business to generate great profits. And then that $3 billion, you know, can easily turn into like $50 billion. It's obviously, a risk is it's a function of
interest rates,
right? But in today's environment, you can imagine generating $50 billion in cash flow every year. Well, I mean, of course you're going to value a business at $23 billion if it generates $50 billion in cash every year, even if it has to like split that pot with partners, doesn't have to capture that much of it to be worth $23 billion.
Right. Do they have a few major partners? Like you mentioned Coinbase. Is Coinbase like one of the dominant partners? Are they one
A special partner because they created USDC.
Yeah.
So no one else created USDC. Circle and Coinbase created it, and then they blew up that partnership, or they didn't blow it up, but they modified that partnership so that Circle sort of owned it, but then Coinbase captured a sweetheart economic deal out of that.
And we
so
don't
there's
know
no other partner.
Roughly what that looks like.
I've heard a couple stories from different highly credible sources that are not exactly the same, but mostly overlap. So if someone goes and partners with Circle and the USDC is minted by Circle and then custodied on the Circle platform, then Circle gets all the revenue from the yield and then can negotiate with the partner how much they get.
Mm-hmm.
If Coinbase custodies the USDC and someone goes and partners with Coinbase, then Coinbase gets the revenue from the yield and can divvy up as much as they need to in that negotiation with the partner.
Right.
My two sources agree on that part. The part that but there's maybe differences, if it's non-custodial, if the USDC is not custodied on either of those platforms, but is like in Phantom Wallet or in some other wallet or whatever, or in a partner's wallet, like, you know, Robinhood or Block or PayPal or whatever, then one source says that it's a 50-50 split between Circle and Coinbase. So I don't know what the real story is there. But regardless of the actual answer, like Coinbase basically has to do no work at this point and gets a lot of money. But if you partner with either of them and you create value, meaning you get people to mint, you know, use USDC, mint more USDC, then you're going to get value as well. So, you know, when Circle signs these partnerships, they're doling out some of this money to partners.
Why did Coinbase, it feels like Coinbase had a lot of the, let's say, initial, like the ingredients that enabled this thing to get off the ground. And if everybody's should otherwise be sitting on a beach and there's not that much work to do, like why would Coinbase not just do this themselves? Why did they choose to partner for it?
I don't know. And maybe they regret it now, right? Because, I mean, there's rumors that Ripple's trying to buy Circle or was trying at least before they IPO'd. And then, I mean, the rumors were like for $6 or $7 billion and Coinbase lowballed at $5 billion. Now it's $23 billion, right? So I don't know what's true versus not true regarding that. But
I wonder if there's regulatory reason to keep them separate too. I don't know what that would be, but.
I have no idea. I would guess they regret not bringing it in-house 3 or 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm. So two things to bring up for this. One is for anyone that's listening and doesn't fully understand what we're saying, I think this is important to explain. So these companies, what happens is they issue a dollar as a stable coin. They can then go and buy a dollar worth of US treasuries, which is giving them 4 to 5% risk-free. So that's when Steve says they can sit on the beach. It's literally because they're just collecting free yield from the central bank paying them out. That's what's happening. And so what's interesting there then is, I mean, there's so many interesting things about this. One is Tether is the absolute dominant player, and we're going to talk about some of the possibilities of how dominant they could end up being. But what's interesting is in some ways, because Tether is a bunch of Bitcoiners, this is like actually a stealth way to like accelerate a Bitcoin standard, because Tether is taking a huge chunk of those profits themselves and just buying new Bitcoin, which is accelerating the whole feedback loop for Bitcoin in the first place. So that's interesting. Two, you know, actually, let me reframe this in a better way. Is it credible for Circle or anyone else to even compete with Tether? We also have a mutual, very credible source. So I guess I mentioned this was my biggest takeaway after the lightning routing stuff from the Bitcoin conference, saying it's ridiculous to assume that anyone can even compete with Tether, and specifically Tether on Tron. So there's the question of the stablecoin issuer and then the network they're using. And his point was that Tether on Tron is so dominant everywhere except in the United States, which I guess the United States, obviously people that are using this in Coinbase, you know, they have to use Circle because Coinbase only accepts that. But I guess his argument is that's like such a small use case compared to the people that actually want effectively dollars outside the system, which are the people outside the United States, that it's such a dominant runaway network effect that almost no one can catch them. I've heard two arguments to me that I find credible that would say, actually, no, you're wrong on that. And those two arguments would be, number one, if you can find a way to share that yield with customers, that the customers would be price sensitive enough to move. And so there are other products I've heard where this is a big debate about being in the United States versus not, and some of the regulatory actions, because I know there's a bill where banks, you know, potentially could try and issue stable coins and share, and they would not want to share that yield, but then offshore could. But so imagine if I'm making 5% as Tether, I give 1% to you, the user, and then someone else comes in and says, well, I'll give you 2%. So there's, I think, a question of how price sensitive is the end user. I think that's a real debate. Some people would say users don't know, they don't care. Others would say it's going to be extremely competitive, cutthroat market, and it's going to drive that margin down, making these not good businesses. The second credible sort of issue I've heard is not that Tether is itself in danger, that they're still going to dominate versus Circle, but that the network itself, which is that even if Tron, which it's crazy to me, that Tron is where all this is happening, like Justin Sun, like how did that fucking happen? That's its own interesting question. But that even if Tether's already won and people aren't really sensitive, oops, sorry, to the microphone, they're not sensitive to the, you know, splitting that yield, could this come back to Bitcoin network via Spark, via Taproot assets, or whatever, something else? And then the only credible argument I've heard there is if the volume of payment flows goes so high that it would crowd out the limited block space on the centralized provider, whatever you want to call it, but let's say a blockchain Tron, that prices spike. In that world, could that price action be enough to drive people back to using Tether on Bitcoin or Lightning?
So many
so much there. Right now.
And we have at least a minute to go.
We have 1 minute.
This is a 60-second talk.
We'll go over a little bit. But clearly, Tether is the dominant player right now. I mean, there's no disputing that. The numbers are obvious. To the point, though, that like it's already game over and they're going to dominate. Not only Circle and USDC can't compete, but no one else, like LightSpark, Lightning Labs, no one else. Like PayPal has a coin. Kraken and Anchorage have a new coin that no one else can compete. I think that's, we cannot make that call right now. It's far too early to make that call. I also think there's like so many variables in this that there's not going to, it's not going to be winner take all. Just the regulatory question. There's going to be like players that are going to be all buttoned up and completely play the regulatory game. They're going to have certain advantages and certain disadvantages. And then players that are like a little more on the edge are going to have advantages and disadvantages. So just that division. But there's a lot of other variables as well. So I don't think it's a winner take all. I definitely don't think Tron is has anything captured. First of all, the history, and I'm not even saying that. You plug in any name you want. I'm not picking on Tron.
And if
already,
you are, it's okay.
Already looking at Tether, though, the history, I mean, it started in Bitcoin, then it moved to Ethereum, then Tron, and now it's on Solana, and now they're introducing it on RGB. They're introducing it on Taproot Assets. They could very Spark. Well introduce it on Spark. So, like, Tether's doesn't care. They just want, like, a reliable platform that is cheap.
But also one that users have a wallet that can accept that, right?
Yeah. But history has shown, like, that can... So yes, but I mean, history's already demonstrated they've moved platforms numerous times, and I don't see that stopping.
But there are some network effects to that, right? Like if everybody in your small town in, I don't know, Venezuela or something is all using Tether on Tron, and you want to accept payments, you're like, no, we're going to use a different blockchain underlying. Like, what is that? Yeah. Just give me the money.
But that's why like Bridge.xyz and other swapping providers and Taproot Assets and Spark just naturally do swapping as part of their architecture. So you can have Tether on Tron, I can have Tether on something else or USDC on something else, and we can pay each other.
I think the question would be, I generally tend to agree with you. I'm just taking the devil's advocate on this, which would be in the past, maybe there wasn't enough of a network effect already established. So the question would be like the countries of Argentina, Turkey, and Vietnam. If, you know, whatever, 90% of the population already has wallets that take Tether on Tron, are they ever going to switch? And maybe, you know...
But here's an example where you don't even know what's happening. So, like, Ryan Gentry posted that he went to Steak and Shake and paid, and he paid with Tether.
Yeah, that's crazy.
How did he do that? Does Steak and Shake know anything about Tether? Does their software stack or their system, they have three providers they partner with. Do any of them know anything about Tether? Actually, one of them does, but it doesn't need to. Because the way the payment, like you can have a wallet that supports Taproot Assets and Tether, and you've got Tether in your wallet, and then it can recognize a Lightning invoice,
yes,
for Bitcoin, and then the payment route goes from your wallet to its to the node it's connected to, which then swaps the Tether for Bitcoin, and then completes the payment along the standard Lightning network. In Bitcoin, and then Steak and Shake receives their Bitcoin. So Steak and Shake doesn't, and like someone was joking about Fartcoin could be used, and so you can literally go to Steak and Shake and pay with Fartcoin.
How did you know what DK had put up in his wallet when he wanted to pay?
He was very excited when Coinbase Assets tweeted yesterday that Fartcoin is available on Coinbase.
Is it really?
Thank God.
Is that new?
Coinbase Assets.
Wow.
Yes.
What a company.
So Steak and Shake can accept any of these coins and doesn't even have to like provide the infrastructure for it. So that's like a real world demonstration of Taproot Assets doing that swapping.
Super cool. Yeah.
So I first of all, for a healthy financial system, I think it's really important for there to be many issuers and not one winner.
Right.
But let's talk about reality though. My view right now, Tether definitely is in a super strong position. I think they're like an amazing as a company, they're in business very strong position. But even though I think they'll continue to succeed, I don't think they'll be. I don't think it's a winner take all market, and I don't think they'll have 100%. I also think they'll definitely continue to explore moving platforms. So like Tron is definitely not like the long term winner here.
Yeah, and the thing you said that's always resonated for me very, very strongly is as the Bitcoin network itself continues to expand, and remember, the Bitcoin network has layers. There's layer one, which is Bitcoin now, layer two, which is Lightning. But there's so much momentum for Bitcoin that, like, for example, when Square accepts Bitcoin Lightning payments, and now I have an option. If I want to pay at a Square terminal, and I can either, and I, you know, whatever, I've got Tron on that speaks Bitcoin, or Tron that speaks, or sorry, not Tron, Tether that speaks Bitcoin, or Tether that speaks Tron, Square's not going to accept Tether that speaks Tron. They'll accept Tether that speaks Bitcoin. So I think, to me, I know it's, you know, it's going to take some time to play out, but I think the long-term vision of Bitcoin, the network winning, is that it is TCP/IP for value. And there's only one protocol. It's like, I joked at this when we had our AI hackathon, like, who here uses the number two protocol for data transfer, the number two protocol for the web? There's right. one. It's only one. And so if you want that Tether or whatever the stablecoin is to win, it needs to speak Bitcoin somehow. It could either be natively with something like Taproot assets, or it could be bridged in. I still think there's a huge opportunity to build a Lightning Network bridge between the shitcoin chains and Bitcoin, but it somehow needs to speak Bitcoin. Number two, it needs to be able to facilitate the kind of payment volumes we expect in the future, which means it can't be done on a centralized blockchain if you expect to have trillions of payments per second. That just can't scale. So that's another reason I'm bullish on Lightning in the long run.
Last comment here before we wrap up. Maybe Austin says, I thought Tether had less transparency than Circle in terms of reserves. I don't know the latest status. I assume Circle being a U.S. company regulated, I assume they are like quite transparent.
Yeah.
Much like any other public, like a Coinbase or a Block or another American public company. Tether historically has definitely been far more opaque, but they've become more transparent over time. And I think, I mean, there's been tons of FUD about Tether, which I've always been critical of, even though I've never had like insider knowledge to know whether do they have the money or not.
Yeah, yeah.
I had no idea. But when I looked at all the criticisms and the analysis saying they don't have any of it, none of it held, the analysis didn't hold water. And I just found it, this came from like university professors like at Texas and a prominent blogger from Stripe who otherwise people think is really smart. And in this case, these people completely botched this analysis. They just didn't.
They just had bad data, or they just had like a point
they
to prove?
Hate Bitcoin and cryptocurrency.
They're just haters.
It's like, yeah. Kind of like instead of, so there's, you know, TDS, Trump Strange Syndrome, and EDS. I guess there's like a BDS or CDS, Cryptocurrency Derangement Syndrome. Why has no one ever said that?
Right.
Maybe I just,
right.
pointed it on. But I mean, it's really a thing, right? So I think it's that. But in any case, there's been so much evidence over time to, I think it's pretty clear Tether has the money. And it, I mean, they claim to be over collateralized, and I believe them.
I mean, they're making billions of dollars.
When the market crashed a couple of years ago, they redeemed more money faster than any bank in history. I think we said it on the show. I had the numbers, you know, a few weeks ago on the show. So I think there's, and also they've been cozying up with the U.S. government more and more over time as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, they freeze transactions. They apply OFAC rules. And right. And they historically don't even allow employees to travel to the U.S., but Paolo was in Vegas last week.
But doesn't Cancer own 5% of it?
Yeah. And so there's just more and more partnership and budding up. I mean, because I think the United States finally realizes, oh, this is a great strategy for the U.S. dollar.
Yeah. Yeah. One last thing I want to say, so we don't totally rug pull our guys as well. And I think we can get much deeper this on a future episode, but I know we were teasing sort of like Wall Street and Bitcoin and stuff as well. While stablecoins is the story, I do just want to give one quick shout out. Circle raised about $1.1 billion yesterday, I believe, in the IPO or whenever it was. I think it was yesterday, right? MicroStrategy launched a new product, Stride STRD, which is one of their mini bond offerings, which raised the exact same amount in one day. So that's a teaser for the future. But all I got to say is the deeper I go down the MicroStrategy rabbit hole and understand them potentially repricing all treasuries, like, oh my God, it is blowing my mind. And that's a teaser for next time.
Yeah.
Awesome. Great conversation, okay, guys.
And we mostly avoided talking about the drama of the week. So congratulations.
Which drama is that? Zats. Oh, Elon
and Trump. And it's like,
yeah,
who cares?
Probably staged.
I said you can just ignore things.
My theory. Staged.
Yeah, it's probably staged.
Oh, wow. Okay. I need to hear that theory then. Now I'm intrigued. I don't really care about the reality, but I care about
just
the
just assume anything you see online, unless it's signed with an Oscar.
All right. I'll give my theory. We'll go 10 minutes up. I think it's a PR strategy. So Trump got what he wanted out of this deal. He got a lot of money from Elon. He won the election. He's happy. He got what he needed from Elon.
Mm-hmm.
I think Elon, like moving away from government and going back to the businesses right around this time frame, was already always sort of the thought and the plan. So that him exiting the government is not a surprise. The way he's exiting, obviously, I mean, yesterday was like insane, right? However, Elon learned a problem over time, which is like there's a lot of people who have TDS or just really hate Donald Trump for good or bad reasons, and then started hating on Tesla and Elon brands and really damaged. I mean, we have friends who sold their Teslas.
Seriously?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's crazy.
We have people who are our friends sold their Tesla because they were embarrassed to drive it around, right? So by Elon going like total ape shit on Trump, it helps, you know, like
reset
write
the
that
scales.
Shit. All of a sudden now it's like if I'm, you know, I can feel more comfortable driving my Tesla. Because okay, Elon got over that or whatever, right?
Right.
So it gives him an escape. And like I think Trump and Elon just chatted about this and are like, yeah, that would be hilarious. They probably have a signal group between each other.
Right.
And they're just laughing. They're like, what's the next outrageous thing I can say? I think they're tweeting or they're messaging back and forth on like, what's the most outrageous next thing I can say?
Yeah.
I buy that. I also think one other sort of good takeaway for us in the sort of Bitcoin community is, no matter what, it's good for Bitcoin. I kind of thought Pierre Richard, once again, was kind of on the money, which is like, assume the fight's real for a second, even if it is, like it's probably fake, but even if it is real, you know, I do think Elon is speaking the truth when he tweets out there that he's like shocked at how little even a really smart, you know, classical autistic engineer can do when you come in the US government, because it's a different kind of system, right? And so I do think that Trump has clearly gotten Bitcoin pilled. Like JD Vance speaking at the conference, he was there last year. Elon already had bought Bitcoin for Tesla and SpaceX.
And himself.
The further he goes down the rabbit hole and realizes actually like we really can't solve the debt problem. As Lynn says, nothing really will stop this train. I mean, it seems to be no matter what, whether they're fighting or not, like everyone realizes and is converging on this belief that like Bitcoin is the answer. So
maybe in the future we can revisit my interview of Elon Musk, Jack Dorsey, and Kathy Wood from 2021.
Yeah.
We can go re-listen to it and see like what's relevant today, what was wrong, what was right.
Right.
That might be interesting.
Otherwise, if you heard it online, it's just about as good as professional wrestling.
That was actually what I was thinking yesterday. This does feel like WWF. But.
Hey, babe.
Shout out to people, Austin and Guillermo and Jimmy and Nick.
Yeah, thanks for
others. Thanks for the audience engagement. We love that.
Yeah.
We'd love to see more.
We learn
from it.
Matt on Twitter. Thanks, Matt.
Yeah, thanks, Matt.
I mean, for those of you who don't know, I mean, Nick is probably one of the most knowledgeable people in the world on the lightning routing stuff. So like the fact that you're dropping knowledge in there, and Austin
love
was
it.
One of our hackathon
and
winners.
And Nick has started Money Dev Kit. So check that out as well.
It looks dope. I'm
all
excited.
Right. Cool. We are 13 minutes over.
Fun episode.
Let's call it.
All right. We're done.
All right. Bye, everyone.
Bye.